You're listening to a podcast from funnyinthemiddle.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this, we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artist by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on funnyinthemiddle.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Tracy and with me are my comrades and co-hosts Ian.
Hello.
And Colin.
Hello.
As you know by now, each episode we take a letter of the alphabet and pick two bands. One lesser known band and one well known band. So we have reached you.
Who?
You.
Who?
Me?
You too.
Yeah.
So, who are we talking about this time?
We will be talking about Ultra Spank and U2.
Me as well?
U2.
Ultra Spank and me as well.
Right. So,
how many times can we make a U2 related joke?
It's just going to go around in circles, isn't it?
It really is.
Now, I can't remember who picked Ultra Spank, so who's going to tell us something about them?
I think it was probably Ian.
Yes, it was.
So,
owing to the fact that I am the only one, maybe in the world, that owns the CD of the debut album.
Quite possibly. It's not even on... Spotify don't own the first album.
No.
Why don't you tell us all about them?
Okay, then. So, Ultra Spank were an American metal band. See, were, not was.
Yes.
Works, it sounds better to
Damn
me.
Damn you, American Wikipedia.
Formed in the late 90s and continued through the very early 2000s. They released two albums, a self-titled one in 98, and the follow-up Progress in 2000. Then they split up 2001 after being dropped by their label due to poor sales of both albums. Which is unfortunate. Apparently, they were formed by three of the original members were in a band called Indica. They split up. I like this particular sentence, so I'm going to read it out. Five original members, blah, blah, blah. Tyler Clark, Dan Ogden, and Pete Murray. Not to be confused with Australian singer Pete Murray.
Yeah.
So, American singer Pete Murray. Not to be confused with... They were originally called Spank.
Yes.
But due to some kind of legal dispute, they chose Ultra Spank at Rob Zombie's suggestion.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, if Rob Zombie's going to suggest something like that...
I believe Rob Zombie went to one of their gigs and said, I feel like I've just been Ultra Spanked.
Which I think is how he talks all the time.
Yes, definitely. But we'll talk about him in about 4 weeks' time.
So it's like, it's... For me,
it's an odd band name, though.
It is. I think that probably...
It sounds like it'd be a dance act.
Yeah.
Ultra Spank.
Well, they've got elements of that, haven't they? They've got the industrial beats and that kind of thing. So they, but I think it's another bit of the whole Human Waste Project snot.
Yeah, just bad.
But they're more metal than dance, than industrial.
Yeah, but they're new metal. And the new metal scene, there were quite a lot of bands with not particularly fantastic names.
Yeah. And I think that probably counted against them. Because they're a great band, they're really interesting. I think because they're definitely second or third wave new metal,
They were not, well, not 98, so that would be second wave.
Yeah, but
because you've got Korn and Deftones are the first wave.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Korn released Follow the Leader in 99, which was a reference to all of the bands coming out.
Everyone did.
I found a new genre name, actually, for them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Someone described them as Mallcore.
Oh, well, that's really harsh. I'd have said Orgy were more like that.
It seemed to be aimed at them fairly disparagingly.
Yeah, no doubt. The thing, but they are like...
No, it wasn't aimed at No Doubt.
No. But they've got like really interesting proggy elements. It's produced by Dave Bottrell, who produced Tool albums as well.
Well, this is what I was going to mention. Listening to it for me, their biggest influence is clearly Tool.
Yeah.
Dave Bottrell didn't produce Undertow, the first Tool album, but they've got riffs that sound like they're very similar, if not stolen from Undertow every now and again. And what's the vocalist's name?
Pete Murray.
Pete Murray.
Not to be confused with the Australian singer.
American Pete Murray, as we shall refer to him throughout this podcast.
And not to be
he's heard Maynard James Keenan.
He has, but I think he's a good and very characterful on his own vocalist.
He's a great vocalist. I don't know if I'd say characterful on his own. I think he's definitely shown his influences there. Because it's basically, you've got Maynard James Keenan, and then every now and again they'll stick a harmony in there and make it sound a bit like Alice in Chains.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of Alice in Chains harmonies in there.
I was thinking about this because while nu metal was a scene where there were loads of bands who were... They were all grouped together, and they were very similar in some ways. There were a lot of... Because it's basically melding metal with other influences.
Yeah.
So you've got the rap metal bits, you've got the industrial metal bits, you've got the funk metal bits. But then Ultra Spank, there's definitely a large grunge influence in there.
Yeah, like they were way out there on the... Proggy, which grungy.
I'd be interested to hear what Indica sounded like. So I wonder if they, because they were older, I wonder if they were from the grunge sort of scene.
I heard a couple of Low Pro tracks, which is one
that was the one afterwards.
They're pretty decent.
Okay, it does sound like a sweetener.
It does. It does. I think there's a Kilgore relation between Low Pro as well.
See, Kilgore
were way more grungy.
Yeah, but I always used to get them confused, and I think that's because Kilgore... The only thing I really knew about Ultra Spank, I never picked up on them at the time, was 5, which is the second track and the first proper track on their debut album, confusingly, was on a free Metal Hammer CD, and I'm fairly certain Kilgore had a track on the same one.
I think they did. Yeah. I think they did. They were active at the same kind of time.
Definitely.
And they definitely had this... like a more mature, grungy, melodic approach, like but in comparison to Cold Chamber.
Yeah,
this is like your like.
Oh, I love Cold Chamber, but yeah, you're right.
Cold Chamber were the sound of angry children,
angry goth children,
and like Ultra Spank and stuff like that were the sound of. It was more considered. I'm not going to say whether the lyrics were any more mature or any better, but they were performed more.
I can't wait till we get onto the lyrics.
I've only listened to the lyrics
so
cursorily.
That said they were Mallcore actually said that it said, what did it say?
I don't know, what did it
Tracy's
say?
Tracy's trying to read her notes, which yet again are in a really small font.
Just
she's
right.
Got the lights on, she's got her glasses on.
Yeah, there's no helping her. We're going to get her one of those magnifying glasses on a chain.
Or one of those big, massive ones on a stand. That
maybe we shall get her to bring them on a laptop and cast them to the enormous TV.
We could do that.
So that she can read all of them.
One word at a time.
I
was once sitting on a bus behind someone reading a book on a Kindle, and I was 5 rows behind and I could read the book perfectly because they'd got about 6 words on a page.
Wow.
Anyway, I found the review in my notes. It said about the lyrics, it said it didn't have that annoying, whiny teenage angst. So.
Yeah, of which new metal was. But, like,
it was a teenage
Jonathan
genre.
Davis' fault, that.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like, Chino's lyrics have never been particularly angsty.
Deftones were always a more grown-up band, yeah. whereas Korn were the sound of I Don't Want to Tidy My Bedroom.
Like, I think that's... and all of the subsequent bands, I think, picked a camp. And yeah. I think Ultraspank were definitely Deftones.
Yeah.
And, like, Coalchamber were Korn.
Yeah. I can definitely dig that.
I'm not sure where Spineshank were.
Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
See, funny you mentioned Spineshank, because this is the thing. I was thinking, now, not to be disrespectful to Ultraspank, but I would describe them as an also-ran nu metal band.
Yeah.
They never made it. They were fairly obscure at the time. I was a big nu metal fan, and I never listened to the album. I was, you know, best mates with Ian for 20-odd years, and I've still never listened to the album, even
though... Whereas I used to... bum it, basically. Yeah. like, this is one of my most listened nu metal albums.
I did think the CD looked a bit weirdly smeared.
Yeah, well.
sorry, that's a horrific image.
Yes, it is.
But
my fiance knows someone whose party trick is that he can put his knob through the centre of a CD.
What?
I believe he was trying to hook up with her at the time, and she was like, well,
let me demonstrate quite small my penis is.
Yeah, why would you tell me that? So, and now here I am.
That sounds like the sort of thing they've done in the stage show puppetry of the penis.
I suspect so, but the thing is, it's going to be like an off-Broadway production of it, because you need to be a lot closer to the stage to see that kind of thing.
So, anyway, going
they
back to where
screens.
I was.
Oh, did... Have you been?
Yes.
Did you see that?
Tracy's been like 27 times. Just followed them round on tour.
Just the once, it was enough.
So, going back to where we were talking about sort of also ran new metal bands, I think, I don't know if that's a horrible term, because it's...
It really is.
It is. But there were a lot of... It was like the landfill indie scene. There were so many bands coming about.
So much, and you had to pick and choose. And
I think if you picked a band at the time, they probably stuck with you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you came to it later on, while there are tracks I like on Ultraspank, I'm not quite seeing them as being brilliant.
Yeah.
Whereas I can't really talk, because I love the first Spineshank album, which is objectively shit.
Yeah, whereas the second Spineshank album, fucking killer.
Don't like it as much. I like the... it's a bit synthier on the first one. Not synthier like an old lady's name. There's more synths on it.
You see, I'm coming at this from a completely different angle, though, because I didn't listen to nu metal.
You weren't there at the time,
no,
were you?
No, not at all.
No.
You were still in
1991 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I started listening to this, and the first couple of tracks I was thinking nothing notable, fairly generic. But then...
Is this the debut album?
Yeah, the debut album. Yeah. But then his voice...
Yeah.
His voice just got me. I fell in love with his voice.
He's got such a good voice.
It's haunting.
Can't argue with that. He has got a good voice.
He can really, really sing. It made me wonder, you know, when we talked about Ocean Size before?
Yeah.
And my main problem was I didn't like his voice much.
Mm.
And I wondered if this guy sang for Ocean Size, would I have liked them more?
Potentially.
Yeah, I reckon it might work.
Yeah.
Because
there are lots of kind of... Like, there's a couple of spacier tracks.
There's proggy elements, definitely, so I can see where there would be some kind of crossover in the sound.
But that one track on the first album, Sponge, just beautiful. It's become my new favourite song.
They did have the sort of nu metal trope of each song title is just one word, and it's just a completely generic...
That actually annoyed me, the one-word titles.
Apart from the opening track, which is 30 seconds long, called No Man, My Hands Are Dirty.
Yes. But I'm quite a fan of, I think it was the third track on the album, Butter.
Yeah.
Do you know, have you read the lyrics of that? Have you worked out what it's about?
No.
It appears to be sung from the perspective of a piece of bread or a bagel or something like that.
Wow.
In a toaster, as the opening line is, "Pull me up from the toaster!" And that's not a misheard lyric. That's the lyric.
Wow. So is he using that as a metaphor for something?
I hope not. I want it to actually be, I'm going to write a song from the perspective of my breakfast.
Maybe he'd done a lot of drugs.
Of quite possibly. On Toast, perhaps.
Yeah. I always really liked Worn, actually.
Okay.
The chorus seems a bit of a push and a change in tempo.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, the pre-chorus is fucking amazing.
There's a really lovely sense of space in that song, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you don't get
really
much in the metal.
Echoey quality.
Yeah, like, the
it,
vocals...
It felt huge.
Yeah, the vocals always reminded me more of, like... his name, Brendan something from Dead Can Dance. Like that kind of classical, slightly operatic style.
Yeah.
And the band did actually just let him do that. Like, they gave him space instead of trying to compete with it, which is why I keep saying it's more mature.
Yes.
Because not playing is the key to that.
It's really easy to just fill up all of the gaps with chuggy riffs on, you know, drop C sharp, first, third... and open frets.
Whereas they don't do that. They've got those riffs.
Yeah.
They've got lots of those riffs.
Well, the guitarist is a guitarist, isn't he? I was watching some live YouTube stuff.
Yeah.
And he plays a PRS.
Yep.
And he was wearing a PRS t-shirt. He's one of those guitarists.
There's two guitarists, though.
Yeah, but the one that I was particularly focusing on going, fucking PRS.
Was it a PRS into a Mesa Boogie?
I didn't see the
that
amps.
That is the new metal trope, isn't it?
I think that it sounds like a Mesa Boogie, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's very American metal.
Yeah.
Like, big, chunky. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got no problem with that.
No.
At the time.
Not my style.
That was my dream rig, but...
You know, there's another influence in there though that I heard, and it'll just be... from my frame of reference, when I was listening to Sponge, and he's got in the chorus the lyrics "holding me, crushing me," and it's almost got a Morrissey tone to his voice.
Yeah,
the Smiths were all of the new metal bands cited Smiths and Depeche Mode.
Yeah, like Kilgore. So many tracks on the Kilgore album have got really Morrissey-esque, but the singer was like this fucking enormous. Super manly guy singing these really Morrissey kind of melodies. Like,
well, I found something from a Deftones interview. Gino Moreno.
See, that's how I pronounce it.
I don't know how to pronounce it.
I assumed it was Moreno, but
Gino Moreno sounds cooler.
Well, when they were recording Gore, he'd been listening to Morrissey. He said, "I've been on this crazy Morrissey tip, totally obsessing over the solo records." And he said...
And now I hate everyone.
Yeah. But he said on them solo records, he had this awesome Elvis-y delay on the vocal and he'd been ripping it off loads.
Yeah.
Well, Gore by Deftones is a really fucking good album, so it works.
Fair. Yeah, I mean, like, if he were to revisit Morrissey now, he'd realise that Morrissey almost certainly hates him. Because with a name like Chino...
Yeah.
Like... Morrissey's probably not down with that.
I don't know. Chino's Hispanic, isn't he? So
yeah.
Morrissey, he loves all his Mexican fans.
Does he?
I'm sure he does. He just doesn't want them to come into his country.
Ah, so yeah. He hates the Deftones when they tour.
We've managed to spill over into episodes later and we're still going on about Morrissey being a cunt.
There's lots of that can happen, really. It's hard not to.
I believe, going back to the same episode we were talking about Morrissey, where we were talking about Snot.
Yeah.
Ultra Spank, I think, were quite good friends with Snot.
Yeah.
They're from the same town.
Yeah.
They're both from San Bernardino, I think.
Bernardino.
San Bernardino. San... SB.
Yeah.
It's in California.
What was the deal with the label, though? I mean, you said it was just poor record
sales. They were on Epic, and I think Epic signed a bunch of metal bands at that point.
There was
I mean, what was it? Were tastes changing? Were they not commercial
new metal.
Because I thought Ultra Spank seemed quite commercial, quite poppy.
Yeah. They were going through a lot of, let's just throw as much shit at a wall and see if it sticks.
Basically, there was a gold rush.
Yeah.
There was... new metal became big, and particularly in America, it was still a fringe thing over here until the early 2000s, when you got like Papa Roach and people like that charting. But back, you know, you got the sort of Korn, Limp Bizkit kind of era. You suddenly, the American record label saw that they could make a fucking lot of money, and it was kids hanging around in malls, which is where the mall court thing comes from. I think we've talked about this in an earlier episode, how some music's audiences were completely different in the UK to how they were in America. And
yeah, because it was just like jocks in America, wasn't it? It was like jock metal.
Yeah.
Which explains a lot of the images of the bands.
Which is why Melody Maker started trying to call it sports metal later.
Yeah.
Which, did, as Melody Maker was a British magazine, did not fit at all with the way that it was actually being listened to over here at that point. I think later on, the kids that actually did sports were listening to, you know, Papa Roach and stuff. But,
yeah, but not, yeah, at the time.
You know,
they, metal fans have traditionally not been particularly sporty in the UK.
No, I can vouch for this.
Yes, same.
I thought that second album was really nice. Well, nice, that's a
I
terrible
think the second
use.
Album, I think, has better crafted songs on it. I think they stick
it
in their head better.
It had slicker production. And the last track on the album is hauntingly beautiful, actually.
I didn't get that far into the second album. It's weirdly, right, considering how much I love the first album, I'm going to blame my girlfriend at the time, because the cover to Progress is a picture of that mouse that had an ear grafted to it.
Yes.
And she was really, really upset by that. And I was like, well, I can't buy that now, can I?
But that mouse can hear things really, really well.
I know, right? And she did not think that was funny.
Can help it get didn't, away from cats.
She didn't think it was amusing at all.
No.
Which is fair. Like, I mean, I can see why they did that, used that image, called it Progress, because it's like, is it?
Yeah.
You know, like, that's...
Had it got a question mark? Was it Progress?
No. It was just Progress.
Okay.
But there was no full stop
on
it, so...
They're making a stand on that there.
They had all these little keyboard interludes at the end and then into the beginning of the next track, which I thought worked quite well.
Ah, yeah.
Well, they had a keyboard player, didn't they?
Pete Murray, the singer, is the keyboard player.
Not to be confused with...
Australian Pete Murray, who was also a singer.
Or Pete Murphy.
Which is who I kept confusing it with.
Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking Pete Murray, wasn't he in Bauhaus? No.
A bit of a left turn from Bauhaus,
isn't
it?
Yeah, very different sound.
We're going to do some progressive new metal now. What? But,
excellent.
Okay.
Just got goth elements.
I got to the end of the second album, though, and the very last line is just a haunting line. It says, "And I'll miss you anyway." And as it ended, I just thought, do you know, I'd listen to that again.
Wow.
I've listened to that album.
I've suggested a band for the podcast, and Tracy likes them. Holy fucking Lou. How many episodes is this?
I know.
Well,
that track, Sponge, I've played it so many times since. It's on loop in my head a lot of the time.
Cool.
Nice.
Every time you say you've been listening to Sponge, I keep thinking of the...
Kicking Pigeons.
Kicking Pigeons, UK ska punk band from the early 2000s that me and Ian once supported.
Yep.
That was an interesting gig. It was a pop punk all-dayer where I was standing in on bass in Ian's band SA10.
Who were a definite second-gen new metal band.
Yeah.
On the angry end of the spectrum.
Right.
Not the corn end of the spectrum. Like, I wasn't angry that someone had fingered me when I was a child.
You were pleased with that?
No, that just didn't happen to me. I was just angry about number of things.
Good to have that clarified.
I think possibly I was angry about still being in possession of my virginity for a lot of the songwriting process. But, you know...
I think there's a lot of that in nu metal.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely most of the audience.
Yeah, for sure.
Anybody got anything particularly else to say about Ultra Spank?
No.
Not really.
I want to go listen to them again, though. I'm glad I've got the album back
thing.
Now. I'm going to put it in my car.
Excellent. I think we should probably talk about you too, then.
Me? Okay.
You as well, yeah.
Unstoppable.
It's never going to get old, is it?
It's not.
U2 are an Irish rock. I was waiting for Ian to say, yeah, me as well.
And me.
Well, you haven't done it yet. Anyway, U2 are an Irish rock band from Dublin, formed in 1976, originally as The Feedback, No, feedback, not the feedback.
No, and then because
the hype.
If they'd been the feedback, that would mean that they actually existed in the early 2000s.
Well, they were the hype after that.
Which is such a shit name.
Feedback and the hype are both fucking terrible names.
Yeah.
Yes.
U2 isn't a particularly good name, but it served them well.
Yeah.
Formed while they were at Mount Temple Comprehensive School by Paul Hewson, otherwise known as Bono, Dave Evans, otherwise known as The Edge, Adam Clayton, and Larry Mullen Jr.,
otherwise known as The Drummer.
Yes, Larry on drums, Adam on bass. Obviously, everybody knows The Edge on guitar and Bono on vocals.
Why did the other two not get a cool nickname each?
I think it was so that they could basically stay as the ones that nobody really knows who they are. So, despite the fact that I think they split all of their money pretty much equally, so they're ridiculously rich megastars.
Yeah.
But they could just, you know, pop into Tesco's without being bothered.
Why is he called Bono?
It's Bono Vox.
Yeah, but why was it called Bono Vox? I know
it
was called that
recently. I remember hearing something like it was a...
No, there was a record store.
It was on an old record
like
store, yeah.
And it meant good vocals.
Yes.
Of course.
Prick.
See, I just hear Beavis and Butthead.
So,
talk about Bono.
The thing with U2 is... they are one of the biggest bands in the universe.
Yep.
Or they at least were. They're still very big.
They're so big and powerful that they can make music magically appear on your iPad.
This is true, but we'll talk about that in a bit.
Yep.
So they released their first album, Boy, in 1980. And then a few albums later released The Joshua Tree, which became the fastest selling British album of all time.
Wow.
Or the fastest selling album in Britain. I don't know if they count as British.
There was a statistic I heard once that of people around my age group, they would say that one in three of them owned a copy of The Joshua
Tree. That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's crazy. The amount of people you see.
I'd rather be pleased to be one of the ones who don't. But
well, see, this is the thing.
But does Tim own it? Because if not,
no.
Then
that means your next door neighbour probably does.
Yeah.
Though.
It's potentially all of your friends that are your age own it. It's just you and Tim that
I
don't.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
Which is now, why you're together.
I've got the album before.
Ah.
I've got The Unforgettable Fire.
The thing is, Joshua Tree, it's rightfully, you know, it is a really good album. I think that you two are... You two? You two...
Us two?
Yes.
Me and Ian?
Much, yes. Basically, everyone thinks you two are cunts.
Yep. Yep. True.
I think they... And I'm guilty of doing it even on this podcast myself.
Yeah.
When we were doing the Queen episode, I was quite disparaging about you two. I've listened to them a lot over the last few weeks. They're fucking brilliant.
Yeah, I know they are. That's the thing. It's just
totally
it's Bono.
Unfair. It's Bono is a bell end.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's quite as bad as people make out.
No, I think he's one of those people that has just been misrepresented in the press.
Yeah.
Maybe a tad.
I mean, I was trying to work out why people hate him so much. And there are legitimate things like they, you know, they're a massively rich rock band,
yep.
But they don't pay very much tax.
Mm.
But then a lot of very rich people
don't pay very much tax.
It's, you know, it's a rightful thing to be pissed off for them at. There's the story about he'd left his hat behind in a different country and sent a plane back to go and get it. So that's a little bit hypocritical when he's talking about climate change and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think they get a lot of hate because they're so successful.
Yeah, and I think maybe if he did less, like, political grandstand... Because people don't like it when people get out of their boxes.
Yeah.
Like, you're in your musician box. I've paid to see you do music stuff. Stop telling me to give money to charity.
But he's got this audience... And if he believes in these causes...
Yeah, no, I can see why he's doing it. I'm just saying that's...
Absolutely valid. I mean, I was watching some footage the other day from the... it was a gig he played in Dublin at around about the same sort of time as the Joshua Tree.
Yeah.
So it was a massive stadium. And he was talking about Amnesty International and trying to get people to sign up. And they got loads more people in that area that started getting into activism and that kind of thing as a result of that concert. It's like... Billy Bragg,
yeah,
massive activist. You know, he's done things for real good for political change and that kind of thing, as well as being a musician. And he was got into it by going to the Clash's Rock Against Racism gig. He didn't go there for the politics. He wasn't interested in politics at all before that.
Oh.
He went there because he was a punk fan, wanted to see the Clash, and there was all this other... You know, that was a gig that was a reaction against Eric Clapton doing... Is Enoch Powell was right?
Fucking yeah.
Bollocks.
Yeah.
And it had a chain reaction effect because Billy Bragg has then inspired loads of other people to get into it, and it's like a fucking chain. And if you've got the opportunity to do that, fucking do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's worked with you two though, because people get annoyed when Bono does it. I don't think he's inspired other people to get into it in the same way.
He's inspired a lot of people, but he's annoyed a lot of other people at the same time.
Yeah, which is basically the way it goes down, isn't it?
Just because he's inspired some people doesn't mean he's not going to annoy other people, and just because he's annoyed some people doesn't mean he's not going to inspire others. And that's the price that he pays for it. And I think he's perfectly okay with that.
Yeah.
But going back to the music...
Yeah, I set myself a challenge to try to listen to...
Everyone?
All of them.
I did that.
Because I know the first five albums really well, anyway. Yeah. I would have seen them from about the age of 12, I'd have been aware of... I'd have seen
so that'd
them...
be about October War sort of time?
Yeah, I'd have seen them on the old Grey Whistle Test. I know on a VHS tape somewhere I've got them doing I Will Follow on the old Grey Whistle Test. Now, that I can't have... seen that when it came out. They must have rerun some old footage at some point, because I wasn't listening when I was 10. I'm sure I wasn't. But by 1984, when they released The Unforgettable Fire, I would have had that as a Christmas present.
Yeah.
And I played it to death. I really, really liked that album at the time. At that point, they were the alternative for me.
Yeah, and they were. They were a post-punk band.
But then by the time they got to the Joshua Tree, they'd become the mainstream for me, and I'd moved on to other things, so I left them behind.
But they hadn't necessarily changed, they just got bigger.
Yeah, a lot bigger.
I mean, yes, they'd got a more sort of expansive sound with the later things, but they have changed a hell of a lot throughout their career, but there's not a massive amount of difference between the first few albums and Unforgettable Fire and Joshua Tree era. There's a much bigger change after that, when they went to the Acton Baby.
I don't know, The Unforgettable Fire was a lot more melodic. I mean, getting Brian Eno in to produce changed that a lot, I think, their sound.
It's where the Edge started using what he's known for his guitar tone with the dotted eighth delay.
Yeah.
Which is the Edge sound.
Oh, totally.
Which is, you know, loads of people have used it since then. I use it all the time.
Yeah, it's an addictive thing. I've used it loads.
It's so much fun.
While I was researching for this, a Twitter friend, Ross, shared that Bill Bailey sketch.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Showing...
Catastrophic failure at a U2 gig.
Yes.
And where his pedal fails partway through a song, and it turns out he's just playing Jingle Bells.
But it's almost entirely accurate, because in It Might Get Loud, which is the documentary where you've got The Edge, Jimmy Page and Jack White talking about guitars for 90 minutes, he does actually show a bit where he's playing through his massive rig, and it's... I'm trying to think which... I think it's Where the Streets Have No Name.
I think so, yes.
And so he's playing it with this really elaborate riff, and then he switches everything off, and it's a little three-note, really simple riff. And it sounds great.
Yeah.
He goes for a minimalist approach. He said it's about efficiency for him. He likes to do things with as few notes as possible.
If you probably work out the ratio to the amount of money that he's made per note.
Gotcha.
He's doing all right, yeah?
Yeah. Pernot actually played rather than Pernot, although he's probably spent a large amount of that fortune on rack unit delay pedals. And
I've seen people write like university level thesis on
his delay use
and stuff like that. It's like, there's an amp there, then there's another one there, then there's a microphone closer. So what you hear is the close mic of that one, then the close mic of that one, then the distant mic of this one, then the distant mic of this one. You're like, what?
And then they've got different length delays on all of those.
Yes.
But you know what? Early on, you would have said that his guitar style was possibly pioneering.
Oh, definitely.
But I don't know. I'm not sure it was so pioneering. I think he was massively influenced by other people before him. I mean, Stuart Adamson, for example.
He was another person at the same sort of time using a lot of effect on his sound.
And he Stuart Adamson was one of the people who first made the Ebo popular.
Yeah.
That's how Stuart Adamson got a very distinctive style.
The Edge did it a slightly different way. He had sustainer system, which was built for him. He had two guitars built, which they called the Infinite Guitar, a sustainer system works by you've got a pickup that sort of is basically almost a speaker.
It's like the reverse of a pickup.
Outputting to the guitar, and then there's another pickup picking it up. So it's a feedback loop built into the actual guitar itself. And they're great.
They really are.
Do you think there's a similarity to the way he does that with Frippertronics?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Frippertronics isn't.
Yeah,
so
not
much
the technique, the delay, the sound, the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, the feedback of the infinite guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
But the delay is definitely influenced by Frippertronics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I reckon probably a lot of bands that would sit there and go, Bono's a prick, I fucking hate you too, their guitarists are like, yeah, but the Edge, though.
If you watch interviews with them, though, Bono is this big fucking rock star dude who the ego is there is no fucking denying that whatsoever. Yeah, yeah. Whereas the Edge seems like a really humble, nice dude, so I don't think everybody would basically agree with the fact that the Edge is a really sound bloke and you'd like to have a chat with him about guitars and stuff.
And the real sound of U2 is the Edge, not Bono. You could replace Bono.
Sort of, but his vocals are very distinctive.
Yeah, but
they become annoying later on, though. When I was listening to some of the albums,
the material isn't as good later on. That's probably what.
When I got as far as Zooropa, I was listening to that. In fact, it's where I gave up. I got as far as Pop and then I gave up. But when it was Zooropa, there was a couple of tracks on there, and I think especially a track called Lemon. And I thought, what the fuck is he on? Does he think he's Prince or something?
Yes, he did. He wanted to. They wanted to bring some funk elements into it and stuff like that. It
sounded fucking awful.
Lemon, Work Better Live. I saw a live recording of that the other day. I was watching, because U2, obviously, when they became the biggest band in the universe, they started really stepping up their stage shows.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had like the Zoo TV tour, where they had massive, like, building-sized video screens behind them and stuff like that.
Well, Zoo TV actually was before Zooropa.
Yeah, that was the Acton Baby tour.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So,
but they did that because apparently beforehand, when they were touring, Rattle and Joshua Tree and Rattle and Hum, they were going up on stage, and when they were touring America and they were doing 60,000 seater stadiums, and they were like, it's just us out there,
exactly.
And they felt really exposed.
Yeah.
So they wanted something bigger.
And if you're at the back, there's not really much that people are able to see.
Can you imagine gigs before big screens?
Yeah.
It must have been so shit.
Well, I've been to big gigs where they've not had screens up. You quite often get it with a support act, don't you?
Yeah.
They don't have the screen switched on. Or if Tool are playing, they just have some animation on rather than...
But that's fine. That gives you something to focus on.
Gives you something to watch,
on.
But you can't see what the band are doing, particularly. Yeah. But, I've definitely seen shows where they have not switched the screens on for the smaller bands.
Yeah.
And if you're far back, you can't see a thing. Particularly if you're my height. But so U2 went, okay, we'll have these massive, massive video screens, and then later on we'll have a massive, giant, mirrorball Lemon.
Why not? Why not? If you've got the resources and...
But I was watching... there's quite a few live videos up on YouTube where I decided to watch a couple of complete gigs. So I watched a show from the Zoo TV tour, which is... That was the era where Bono was...
Oh, when he was in character as the Fly.
He'd got a few different characters. There was the Fly, which was him with his leather jacket and his big, massive sunglasses on. Yeah. And then he got Mr. McFisto, which was a bloke, basically he got white makeup on his face, like kabuki sort of makeup, devil horns and a gold suit.
Interesting.
He used to make phone calls from the stage. Salman Rushdie was in exile at the time, and they used to phone him up because they knew where he was, because he was Bono.
What did Salman Rushdie do about that? Was it like...
I think Salman Rushdie was okay with it.
Did he say, shut up, Bono?
No,
I think... self-righteous twat.
No, they were mates.
Bono, the time difference, man. It's fucking 4 in the morning.
Yeah, and then the Islamic terrorists that were after him, that had put a jihad on him, went, oh, we've worked out from the time zone where you are. That probably wouldn't be ideal.
No.
No.
So, that's it. You two were selling lots of tickets to... like jihadis.
So whatever the equivalent of the Taliban at the time.
Just to rock up, so we're like, right, we know.
It's weird though, do you think with all of the huge stage set going on, do you think it all became a bit Spinal Tap eventually?
Funny you should say that. They had quite a few occasions on the Pop Mart tour, which was the one where, so the encore on that, there was a giant lemon at the side of the stage for the first main bit of the show,
obviously,
and then for the encore break they had like loads of sort of dance music type stuff on because they were into that kind of thing at the time.
Yeah.
And this lemon moved across the stage and then it was supposed to open and then all get out and start playing, and there were quite a number of shows where it didn't and they had to climb out of a little hatch on the top. I couldn't find any footage of that, but it apparently happened quite often.
Amazing.
The Edge has said in an interview that he'd watch Spinal Tap and weep rather than laugh.
You get a lot of touring musicians that say that.
Yeah. Like anyone that's in a band, you watch Spinal Tap and you're like, okay, that's exaggerated, but not as much as you think it is.
Yeah.
Even some of that's... Well, you'd got people like Black Sabbath who watched it at the time and went, okay, well, that was us.
Yep.
The
Stonehenge thing.
Well...
Because theirs was the reverse, wasn't it? They got a Stonehenge monument, but it was too big to fit in most of the venues.
Yes, but you know what the best thing about that is?
What?
That didn't inspire Spinal Tap.
Did it not?
That happened afterwards.
So you mean they didn't learn?
They didn't learn. No, Black Sabbath, the tour where they had Stonehenge, was mid to late 80s after Spinal Tap had already been released.
That's fantastic. That is fantastic.
So, but yeah, going back to where I was ages ago, where I detoured into the live thing.
Yeah.
Lemon sounded a lot better live.
Right.
There's a couple of their songs that sound fucking terrible on the records, but did work quite well live. The album that they forced everyone with an iPod or an iPhone to have, it was the album before that. It was No Line on the Horizon. The title, which
I listened to that one on purpose at the time, and I was like, "This is really dull."
It's the worst record they've done, definitely. Yeah. I tried listening to pretty much all of their albums. I didn't actually get as far as the latest one, Songs of Experience, but No Line on the Horizon. My notes on here are utter shite, really boring.
Yeah.
But then last night I was watching loads of YouTube videos, and they were on the Culture Show. And they played a live version of the title track, and it was really good.
Yeah,
really.
So
I got as far as Pop and the opening track, Discotheque, and I just thought, God, this is horrible.
Oh, I like Discotheque.
Discotheque's a tune.
I couldn't go on after that.
Pop, I actually quite like the album. People absolutely hated it at the time, apart from all the millions of people that bought it.
Yeah,
but it was definitely one that split people because they were quite different from. They were heading in that direction with Acting Baby and Zeropa.
Yeah.
But they turned the dance element up. I mean, was it 97? Yeah, it was 97. So it was the height of Prodigy, Chemical Brothers and
yeah, yeah,
the big beat kind of thing, and that was what Bono was wanting to sort of do at the time. And apparently Larry Mullen, because there were loads of programmed drums and it was totally different to the style he's used to playing, he didn't enjoy it so much at the time. I think he learned to enjoy playing them live.
Yeah.
But he didn't enjoy the recording of the album so much.
Because he had nothing to do.
Because he was still playing on it, but it was in different rhythms to what he was used to playing.
Right.
It was a lot straighter for... I mean, if you listen to his drums on Sunday Bloody Sunday, they're absolutely amazing.
Do you know
they're
what?
Really syncopated.
Do you know what? If you go through the first... If you go through which albums... You go through War in October and play the first 5 seconds of Sunday Bloody Sunday, Seconds, Like a Song, The Refugee, and then the next album, I Throw a Brick Through a Window, With a Shout, and Scarlet. It just sounds like a drum sound check.
Were you just funny. Skipping through things?
Yeah, just a bit. It just sounds... Yeah, if you just play the first 5 seconds of all of them, it's a brilliant drum sound check.
Okay, can you just play a bit of your toms now, Larry? Yeah, thank you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, stop, no, not the full kit, just the toms.
Have you seen the video where the Edge falls off stage?
No.
It's amazing, because he's playing, walking down the Ego platform.
Yes.
Yeah.
With loads of delay on, then he falls off stage and the delay's got delay on as well.
I have seen that, I've forgotten about it though.
I once threw a guitar across a stage with a load of delay on it, and as it hit Frenchie, the bass player... That looped.
Nice.
It's quite good, that.
Is that the last gig you did with Lando?
No, it was one of our best gigs. That was the Skull Club.
Oh, right.
It wasn't an angry throw at him. It was a, I'm just going to do this because I'm bellend, basically.
Do you know what I hadn't remembered from revisiting Boy? I'd forgotten that they've got a glockenspiel almost every track.
Yes, I actually said this to my wife yesterday when we were in the car listening to it. I was like, glockenspiel on this, Tracy will be definitely mentioning that.
And it's, there it is.
Yes.
There it is.
It's a fucking great album.
Tick it off on your Tracy bingo card. I loved it. I mean, there's a Husker Du track on Warehouse Songs and Stories, She Floated Away, that's got a similarly paced glockenspiel part, and it's just brilliant.
But you can also tell, glockenspiel's really hard to record.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you can tell that they were struggling, because it does sound a bit dodgy on, particularly on I Will Follow.
Yes.
It sounds like you're not quite getting the full frequency of what you're hearing.
But in some of the other tracks, it comes across really well.
But that whole album is... I'd never listened to it before. I knew I Will Follow, but...
Fear Factory covered I Will Follow.
Yes.
Did they?
Yeah, it's a really good cover.
And it's a really, really good post-punk album.
It is.
I knew basically War and a few of the others. Because I'd avoided them for years. I was in the... opinion that no, they're shit, fuck off, they're, you know, Bono's
see, like great. I say, I'd stopped after Joshua Tree, so.
And if you're one of the people listening that thinks that, give them a chance.
Yeah, like, the thing is, you don't get to be that size by being shit.
But stop at pop.
Like, as a legit band. Obviously, you get pop artists that get to being that size for no obvious fucking reason, Justin Bieber. but, like... This is back in the day when you had to work for it, so it's like...
Well, that's it. They toured and they toured and they toured.
And
particularly in America.
Yeah.
They had much drive.
They were America's favourite band in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And 90s, I imagine.
Yeah.
There's a track on Actung Baby, Acrobat, that if you took the vocals away, it's a really nice post-rock piece.
and
the thing is... It's the latter-day Bono that annoyed me, and I thought, if you can take the vocals away from most of it, I would probably like a lot more of it. Someone like the Manic Street Preachers, a band that you might otherwise like without the vocalist.
I like the Manics.
It's like Limp Bizkit. Musically, I love Limp Bizkit. Vocally, I hate Limp Bizkit.
Yeah.
Perhaps
they should swap. Perhaps Bono should join Limp Bizkit and Fred Durst should... No, that's
Jesus
a fucking
Christ,
terrible idea.
That sounds fucking nightmare.
You know what?
And
I think
Pete Murray should join Oceanside.
Pete Murray should join Oceanside, yes. Who should reform, but probably won't.
No, particularly not if Mike Van Aart has been replaced by Pete Murray.
Well, no, he still gets to play guitar.
Maybe we could get the Australian Pete Murray.
Or Pete Murphy.
Maybe we could get all of the Pete Murrays. Oh. I bet we could form a band of Pete Murrays.
A Pete Murray choir.
Here's a fun fact, actually.
Better be now, you've said it now. It is. Picked it up.
And it was when you mentioned, mentioning goth bands, mentioned Bauhaus. The Edge's older brother, Dick, was the singer of the Virgin Prunes.
Ah.
Dick Edge.
Sorry, not the singer. Sorry, he's not the singer. Because that's obviously Gavin Friday. He was in the Virgin Prunes.
But is his name Dick Edge?
No, it's Dick Evans.
Could be worse. It could be the Dick. That's my name.
So, I think we should probably discuss it. When Ian has composed it. excellent. Ian's just now, he's trying to be all zen.
Okay, cool. I'm back. I'm back in the room.
Another thing that you two did that fucking pissed people off, though, was the iTunes thing.
Yeah, because that was such a dick move.
It's
like the opposite of Radiohead's. Like when Radiohead were like, pay what you want for this, you can have it if you want. You two are like, motherfuckers, this is yours.
It's essentially,
look how cool we are. We're giving you this.
Essentially, they raped people's iTunes libraries.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
It's got to have been the album that... It must be the album that's owned by the most people that has never been listened to.
Yeah, I've never listened to it.
I hadn't until last week. And it's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
There was no goodwill left.
No, that's the thing. It's like, if someone else gave you a free album, like it's just the way of doing it, isn't it?
It's the way it was forced out, and it wasn't just in there as a normal album that you could just go, oh, fine, I'll delete that. You had to get a fucking rootkit program type thing to actually delete
it. Yeah, it was almost like it was a virus with the iTunes release.
I think some people actually tried to get it classified that it was a virus.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like what Microsoft do with Internet Explorer, and they're not allowed to actually include it with the Windows setup anymore because it's bundling, and it's the whole.
Are they not allowed?
Other browsers are available.
Is bundling not allowed? Because I'm sure whenever you buy anything like a phone or a laptop, you've got loads of fucking bloatware on it.
Maybe on phones, but I mean a copy of Windows doesn't come with a copy of Internet Explorer. You have to be now.
You couldn't uninstall it before,
right? Okay.
Whereas now you can. Also, it's not Internet Explorer anymore. It's
Microsoft Edge,
which is not
holy shit. It's the Edge.
It is a virus.
We thought it was Bono,
but he's the good member of you two. He's the one that's a goodie. But.
You'll not be surprised to know, actually, I don't have an iTunes account.
No, I'm not surprised by that at all.
No.
So I've never heard that album.
Tracy is currently sitting on a sofa with a blanket over her legs because, and I quote, it's cold and I'm an old lady.
Yep.
It's freezing in here.
It is pretty chilly.
No, I'm sitting here in a T-shirt. I've got more layers of insulation than everyone else, though, to be fair.
At least you said it.
I have only my wrath for Bono to keep me warm.
Surely that should be pretty toasty then.
I watched, just randomly watching things on, you know when YouTube auto-plays into another related video?
Yeah.
And I actually ended up watching a full-length 90-minute-long documentary film about a U2 fan trying to meet Bono and get brought up on stage.
Really?
Called U2 Brother. It was this guy in Canada who is... It's called U2 Brother because that's his car number plate.
Wow.
And he's... it was chronicling the fact that he'd met Bono a couple of times. And it's normally you'd sit there and go, really, that's not really much to write, make a documentary about.
Yeah.
But it was quite enjoyable.
I
quite liked it.
Watched... I've forgotten the name of the comedian. He looks a bit like Bez, but with long hair. John something.
John...
Bishop.
Bishop.
I saw him, and he was saying, like, he was on tour in America, and he flew a load of his mates out to try and impress them, and they were like, yeah, whatever, John. You know, being very, like, standard northerners about it. And then they were like, you two are playing, do you reckon you can get us tickets to you two? And he was like, Yeah, right. So he gets tickets, but he manages to get backstage pass, or he gets invited backstage. And his mates are like, wait, fucking what? Oh, right, okay, yeah, you are famous then, I get it, right, yeah, cool. And he goes backstage, and Bono calls him by the wrong name. And he's like, fuck, what do I do? Shit, oh, because obviously you can't tell Bono that he's just called you the wrong name when he's been told what your name is and stuff. But then, like, apparently, 6 months later, he got a card saying, to Mark, love Bono. Like, so Bono obviously knows what he's done. No, that was it. He's got Bono's fucking phone number.
Yeah.
And, like, Bono texts him with the wrong name and stuff. So, like, I don't think he is that much of a prick. I think
I think he's got a sense of humour, but he's such a famous person that he can't work on a normal level anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and they were fairly youngish when they
He's in fucking Prince and Michael Jackson territory, virtually, isn't he?
In level of fame, absolutely. And everyone thinks he's a prick because he wears his sunglasses all the time, but he has got glaucoma.
Has he?
Glaucoma, or however the fuck you pronounce it.
That one, the eye thing, glaucoma.
Yeah. So
I didn't know that.
He's allowed... Well, that I was...
Also, if someone asked... If I was at Bono level of fame and someone was like, why do you wear your sunglasses all the time, you prick? I'd be like, because I'm one of the most famous rock stars in the world. Suck my balls. Right? Basically, I should be famous so that I could go around and respond to as many questions as possible with suck my balls.
Yeah.
I'd be a good rock star.
Yeah, I think you would.
He's like super unapologetic about stuff.
You got the requisite level of bellendery.
Yeah, like...
Just not the fame to actually excuse it.
Basically, yeah. Like, I don't really have the ego, but I'm definitely enough of a dick to rock that level of fame.
But, you know, even with their level
of fame...
Bear
that in mind.
They had a failed venture on Broadway.
Oh, the Spider-Man
the musical.
Yeah.
Spider-Man musical? How have I not heard of this?
It was a few... About maybe 5 or 6 years ago, something like that?
Yeah, 2007.
Oh, fuck. 11 years ago.
It was called Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. And they had loads of delays and...
Well, that's what the edge is known for.
Yeah. Loads of delay.
On stage accidents, which is also known for.
Yep.
It cost about $65 million in the end.
Wow.
It ended up as the most expensive show ever staged on Broadway that just flopped.
It sounds rubbish. I'm not really sure how well a Spider-Man stage show would work.
I dig Spider-Man.
I like Spider-Man.
Didn't they have people flying over the audience on wires?
Fucking better do. If you're doing a Spider-Man musical, he's got to be swinging over the audience.
Yep.
I don't like musicals, so I don't think I dig it.
Was it a musical?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, no.
It was one of these like pop musicals like the We Will Rock You Queen one, but it wasn't using written U2 songs. They wrote new music for it.
But, yeah, see, I've got no interest in seeing We Will Rock You either.
No, I've got no interest in seeing pretty much any musicals.
No.
I have seen The Lion King, and it was quite good.
But Team America, that's a musical. That counts.
I've always thought I'd like to write a pop musical based around teenage fan club songs.
But only you would go.
Not even teenage fan club would go. You're like, no, this is a fucking travesty.
Norman would turn up, and that's why you want to... Oh, no, it's Gerard that you'd want to turn up.
So if Norman turned up, Tracy would be sad.
No.
Yeah.
No, you'd be like,
send Gerard.
Why are you here? I wanted the other one.
I think it'd be a great musical.
Okay, you do that then.
Yeah, you write it.
I'm sure you'll be able to buy the rights for like 50p.
And also, if there's a chance of anyone becoming really, really famous about it, remember that I'm good at being famous.
Okay.
So if you make a load of money...
I'll give you a starring role.
Exactly. Make me really... Yeah. I could be the person that isn't really invested in Teenage Fan Club.
Singing their greatest hits.
Yep.
Excellent. I think we've probably said pretty much all we were going on U2 there.
And Teenage Fan Club and all manner of other things.
So, next episode is the letter V. So...
Vegetarians.
Is that a band?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Their album is called Wood. I'm not even joking.
Brilliant. I think what we'll actually do, though, is we will go all gothy and synthy and talk about VNV Nation.
Yes.
And also go all 80s metal and synthy and talk about Van motherfucking Halen. Hell yes.
You don't put delay on that.
No. He used delay occasionally, but not that often.
No, you just should, though, because it's the U2 episode.
Yes. When people are listening to it, we're
dotted eighth notes.
Basically going to be inaudible. I'm just going to put dotted eighth notes on everything. Dotted eighth delays.
So there'd just be bits that just go bono, 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 bono.
Yes.
Jesus Christ, that's horrifying.
Perhaps I won't.
Maybe you should.
Or shall I? But on that note, we've been Weirding Music. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bono, 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 Bono.